Okay, Alexandra, let's talk about the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan and the meeting that took place in Moscow to broker some sort of ceasefire. It looks like that ceasefire has been brokered, but I jumped on to Russian state media, RT, and the title of an article that came out says, "No end in sight. Armenia and Azerbaijan accuse each other of violation minutes after Nagorno-Karabakh ceasefire was supposed to begin." So I don't know if that's just a flare-up or if they're not taking the brokered ceasefire seriously. What's going on?
Well, it's probably more than a flare up, but it's not yet conclusive proof that the ceasefire has completely broken down. I think we need to understand the context of this. I mean, Azerbaijan, as we've discussed in these programs, with the backing of Turkey, with apparently 150 Turkish officers now taking command positions within the Azerbaijanian army, launched this offensive. There are apparently also Turkish aircraft, F-16 fighters, in Azerbaijan, and there have been satellite photos which show them there. Erdogan and the Turkish government denied it, but they've now been actually photographed in Azerbaijan. So they launched this offensive, and for a couple of days, in fact, for about a week, there was lots and lots of information coming out of Azerbaijan, coming out of Ankara, that the Azerbaijanians were advancing purposefully and successfully and effectively. And Erdogan was saying that Nagorno-Karabakh, this Armenian populated region, which the Azeris claim as their own, and which they have lost control of, but which, that this would be sort of liberated. In other words, that it would come once more under Azerbaijanian control. And the president of Azerbaijan, President Aliyev, was saying essentially the same thing, that, Azerbaijan had waited for too long. They'd waited for 30 years for a negotiated process to succeed, and it hadn't succeeded. And now they were going to go all out to reconquer this territory. And in fact, what has happened is that they did not reconquer this territory. They made a small amount. They gained a certain amount of ground in a few villages, not in Nagorno-Karabakh itself, by the way, but in areas around it. But the latest information is that the Armenians have counterattacked and they're being pushed back. And moreover, it's becoming increasingly clear that Azerbaijan and Turkey are diplomatically very isolated over this. So, unsurprisingly, this is the moment when the Russians, who have been quietly backing Armenia and increasingly not so quietly, the Prime Minister of Russia is currently in Yerevan, the capital of Armenia, supposedly to attend a summit meeting of the Eurasian Economic Community there. But undoubtedly, this has been green lighted to proceed because this has been obviously an important, way of showing, indicating who Russia is backing at the moment. Anyway, the Russians use this opportunity of the Azeris being thrown back to call for negotiations. The foreign minister of Azerbaijan, it wasn't sure that he would come, but he did eventually come to Moscow, and there has been this agreement brokered, which is for a ceasefire. And increasingly, it looks as if that ceasefire will be the start of a process which I have no doubt will lead eventually to essentially the original ceasefire lines, the status quo lines being resumed. So this is an offensive launched by Azerbaijan, prompted by Turkey. It hasn't succeeded. Lots of people have been killed, but apparently conditions are getting worse also in the mountains. It's now October. The weather has got worse. Winter is pending. There's no breakthrough. People are dying, and nothing has been achieved. And Erdogan's attempts to get Putin to accept him as a partner in brokering the ceasefire have failed. The Russians have frozen him out, and they're only dealing with the Azerbaijanians and the Armenians directly. So that's where we are. Now, it's not over. It's not played out. There may very well be more trouble in the next few days and weeks. And of course, there is still the issue of all these thousands of jihadi fighters that have moved into the Caucasus at the invitation of Erdogan and of Aliyev. And they will be very difficult to control, as they always are. So it looks as if yet again, one of Erdogan's ventures has now hit the buffers, but it's not over, it's not played out. And once again, and I'm sure this is a point you're going to be asking me about, the Russians have pulled their punches. They've given Erdogan and Aliyev an off-ramp by calling for negotiations. They haven't acted in a way that would basically throw the Azeri army back. They haven't imposed, as they could very easily do, terms on Baku and Ankara. So, you know, that's something we need to talk about also, but that's where we are at the moment.
Well, let's talk about that, because at this very moment, like you said, maybe short term, there'll be a ceasefire. And maybe this stalemate will continue medium to long term again, and it'll remain a frozen conflict. But it doesn't change the fact that you have now, you said, 1,000 jihadists sitting once again to the south of Russia, ready to destabilize Russia and destabilize the region. So how is Russia going to deal with this? Are they just going to once again let Erdogan have his way, or will they finally deal with this problem before it becomes a really big problem for them?
Right. Now, we're getting contradictory messages from Moscow on this. We see the head of the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, who's a man called Naryshkin, who is very close to Putin, has been raising alarm bells about this. He's been making public statements, which is very unusual for him to do, about the fact that there are these jihadi fighters there. He has publicly blamed Turkey for their presence. He has said that it's Turkey's involvement in this conflict which has made the stakes much higher than they have ever been before. And he is clearly lobbying very, very hard for a very strong response. I get the impression that Lavrov, who is the foreign minister, is doing the same. I get also the impression that there are other people within the Kremlin who are dragging their feet on this. Now, there is a political calculation. Russia does not want to, as they would say, lose Azerbaijan. They've got good relations with Azerbaijan. They've got good relations with President Aliyev. They don't want Aliyev to fall. They don't want to see even more chaos in the Caucasus that might result from President Aliyev falling, which he might do if he was publicly and openly militarily defeated. And as you discussed in another program, there are many Russians who are very heavily invested, both politically and psychologically and also financially, in a strong relationship with Turkey. So there are these factors that are playing themselves out. I think what the Russians will do is that initially they will try and lean on Aliyev, who is on good, has historically had good relations with them, to get him to get the Turks out, to get these jihadi fighters out. They will point out to him, you've launched another offensive, it hasn't worked, the Turks can't help you, we will always back Armenia. In the end, if you continue to go down this road with the Turks, you will only land yourself in trouble. And these jihadi fighters that have been introduced into this area are not your friends. They are ultimately some people who will be extremely antagonistic to you, because as far as they're concerned, you're a secular president of Azerbaijan and your country is Shia, which they consider a heresy. So they are dangerous for you as they are dangerous for us. And don't listen to Erdogan, who is leading you up the garden path. I think that is one of the things the Russians will be doing. And Putin has had a telephone conversation with Aliyev. He's refused, apparently, to speak to Erdogan. And he will be trying to put that kind of pressure on Aliyev. If it doesn't work, if Aliyev doesn't do what the Russians are asking him to do, then the question is, what do the Russians do? I am going to say straightforwardly, I think the Russians will not tolerate the presence of Islamist fighters in Azerbaijan and in the Caucasus, if they seem to want to sort of implant themselves there, and Aliyev won't remove them, sooner or later the Russians will do it, and they will do it themselves. Now, I also ought to say, I understand that there have been more Russian supplies sent to Armenia. I've heard reports that there have been also arms supplies sent to Armenia through Iran, which has been trying, by the way, to play an even-handed game, but which has been tilting towards Armenia in this conflict. And I also understand that there are a lot of Russian advisors now in Armenia. So, you know, there is some sort of a movement there from the Russian side. But ultimately, if the diplomatic course doesn't work, the Russians, I think, will intervene.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Iran, actually. I don't know if you want to expand a little bit on that. One of my questions was on Iran, and the other one is on the longer that you have these jihadist fighters brought in by Erdogan, the longer you allow someone like the CIA to exploit that fact. So, I mean, I don't know how much time the Russians really have to deal with this problem before someone like the CIA gets in there and really starts to cause a lot of trouble.
Absolutely. It could explode on them. And by the way, this is exactly what Naryshkin, the head of the Russian intelligence service, I mean, he was basically making exactly that point. I mean, he's very, very concerned about it. And I know that he's a person of great influence. I mean, Putin listens to him. And he was formerly, before he became head of the Russian intelligence service, he was speaker of the Russian parliament. So he's got lots of political connections throughout the political system. So we will see whether he is able to prevail. He's not the only person, by the way, who's raising these flashing lights. Others will too. But as you absolutely rightly say, the longer the Russians wait before they respond, the more these people become embedded and the more dangerous they become. And of course, the more the opportunities grow for hostile forces, not just the CIA, by the way. I mean, you know, bear in mind, you know, there's also, it's fairly well known that Saudi Arabia at one time in the 2000s was supporting jihadi fighters in the Caucasus. And, you know, the situation in Saudi Arabia could change very quickly. So, you know, it should be very, very concerning for the Russians to end this thing and to end it fast. I think, well, I have no doubt Putin himself understands this. The question is, how long are they prepared to wait? One thing I will say, I recently read a very interesting article by Patrick Coburn in The Independent, who's a British journalist. He's been following the situation in Syria. And basically what he's saying is that this jihadi enclave in Idlib province that we've been hearing so much about is now on the verge of complete collapse. Two-thirds of it are once more apparently under Syrian government control. And there is a major humanitarian crisis in what's left of it. And more people are leaving it. And most of them are now, most of them that are left are strung along refugee camps on the border with Turkey. So, you know, Russia has gradually edged Turkey out of Idlib. They need to do the same in the Caucasus, but they can't wait as long in the Caucasus as they did in Syria. They need to do it much, much faster.
Hmm. Do you have anything to add about Iran, or should we wrap up this?
Let's talk about Iran, because Iran is, of course, another major player. Iran has a very large Armenian community, which is, by the way, always been on good terms with the Iranian government, whichever government it is, whether it was the Shah or the present, you know, Islamic government, you know, of the Ayatollahs, it's always got on good terms with Iran. It's also had Iran has always had a sort of rather uneasy relationship with Turkey. Turkey and Iran have fought many wars historically. Because, of course, Turkey is a Sunni country, Iran is a Shia country. Relations have never been entirely easy. They've been much friendlier in recent years because Erdogan sought good relations with Iran, but in this conflict, Iran has tilted more towards Armenia, which it has also had good relationships with. Iran's overriding concern is that it does not want to see the United States establish itself in any of these Caucasian countries. It's got the United States to its south in the Gulf. It doesn't want to have the United States to its north in the Caucasus. So they will be very concerned to make sure that the United States does not establish itself there. And they do not want to see the US there under any circumstances. Implicitly, they are therefore backing what the Russians are doing. They want the Russians to succeed in brokering a ceasefire. They want the Russians to keep Azerbaijan out of the American camp. And they also, like the Russians, want to see these jihadi fighters, who are the deadly enemy of Iran, out of the Caucasus too. So at the moment, the Iranians and the Russians are speaking the same language about the Caucasus. And in fact, the Iranians have thanked the Russians for brokering the ceasefire today. But if the Russians don't act, bear in mind, Iran has shown a capacity to do so in the past, and it may very well do so in the future. It's got strong interests in Azerbaijan, a Shia country like Iran, and they might very well decide at some point to act themselves to eliminate these fighters if the Russians don't do it. And they've got good relations with Armenia as well.
All right, we'll leave it there. Boy, Erdogan, he really turns the region upside down.
He turns everybody upside down. And I come back, I will finish by saying this. I think he is running out of road. There is something fevered about this. I mean, he started this war in Syria, which, as I said, has ended badly. And apparently Idlib is in severe crisis. He then started something in Libya, and that's run into the buffers with the Egyptians. He then started things in the East Med, and then that brought the French down on him. And now he's playing in the most dangerous region of all, which is the Caucasus, where he's going against the Russians and the Iranians in an area which is of vital importance to both Russia and Iran, especially to Russia, but also to Iran. And it's beginning to look fevered and desperate. And, you know, I know that, you know, there's some people from, you know, who think we are taking an excessively anti-Erdogan to take on these things. But I cannot see how this benefits Turkey at all. Turkey needs to pull out of these conflicts, not to get drawn into them all the time, and to let these problems sort themselves out, which they would do, I think, quite quickly if Erdogan wasn't all the time, you know, spilling around the pot. I mean,
they're not getting drawn in, though. They're starting them. I mean, we have to... Syria, they really went aggressively after Assad.
Oh, absolutely.
Same with Libya, same with the East Med, same with Azerbaijan. Yeah. They're starting these conflicts.
As I said, they need to stop doing that because, for the moment, they've managed to avoid getting into a really big crisis, principally for two reasons, because Putin and in the East Med, Merkel, have provided Erdogan with off-ramps. There may come a point when they stop doing that. Either, you know, Putin loses patience with Erdogan, or he's replaced by another Russian leader who's far less sympathetic to Erdogan than Putin is. And with Merkel, of course, she's likely to go very soon anyway. So it's not, I think, a wise policy. It could so easily blow up in Turkey's face. And bear in mind, it's only a few years since Turkey faced a major terrorist problem on its own territory with all sorts of Islamist fighters and people connected with ISIS planting bombs all over Turkey, killing hundreds of people. So these are very, very dangerous games that Erdogan is playing. You know, if you are in a, you know, a gunpowder. If you're surrounded by gunpowder, you don't play with matches. And he plays constantly with matches. The adults come and they take them away from him. But, you know, one day maybe they won't come. And then what happens?
Yeah, we'll leave it there. Alexander Mercurs, thank you very much, guys. Like this video, click on the subscribe button, hit that like, share this video as well. Please donate to us on PayPal, Patreon, and subscribe. Star, your donation helps out this channel a lot. And please go to the Duran Shop, pick up some merch. That also helps us out a lot.
Indeed. And we've got lots of magic mugs now with flags on. This is the flag of Greece. I believe Alex has the flag of Armenia. There you go. And we've also got another magic mug, by the way, just to emphasize Armenia. There we go. Yeah, yes, Armenia. And I think we've even got one of Turkey somewhere, if I'm wrong. And of the United.
No, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. I don't have it with me, but yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'll tell you. I think we put Slovakia.
Slovakia.
I think we got Slovakia, Turkey. British Columbia, put the flag of British Columbia up.
Russia,
Belgium.
Belgium.
And I'm trying to think. We put like five, six different flags up this week.
Yeah. So this is just to make clear that, you know, we do provide analysis. We're not driven by some nationalistic fervors, as some commentators say. But you will find our mugs on our shop. They are the best mugs in the world. They come with all these amazing flags, and we've shown you that they're both, you know, they come. These are porcelain, the best porcelain mugs anywhere. And we've also got the most amazing enamel mugs. This one has the flag of Germany, by the way. So you can see all of these different countries. We also, by the way, have the flag, obviously, of the United States, as Alex was showing you. And we have increasingly mugs with the flags of American states. I saw Texas, but I'm sure more are coming. And we've got flags now on our shirts. Many of our shirts are amazing, wonderful 100% cotton shirts, which come as both long-sleeved and short-sleeved T-shirts and as the best polo neck shirts in the world. And we've got flags on our hats too. As you could see, that's the flag of the United Kingdom of Great Britain, the great nation that I live in. And this is also another, you can see it more clearly perhaps there because of the color contrast, the British flag. So we've got hats, we've got truckers' hats and bikers' hats, and we've got embroidered hats and embroidered shirts, and we've got hoodies, and we've got stickers, and we've also got ebooks. We've got amazing things. Alex has been renewing and refreshing our shop. The product line in our shop is growing exponentially and wonderfully. These are wonderful things. You support the Duran by buying these wonderful things from our shop. And at the same time, you become the proud owner of these wonderful things when you buy them from our shop. So Alex will quickly now remind you how to do that.
You'll find the link to the Duran shop down below underneath this video. And the five and the flags that we put up, actually, we put up Belgium, we put up British Columbia, we put up Turkey, and we also put up a really cool flag, which I like a lot on the apparel, and that is the flag of Japan.
Wow, yeah. That's
and it looks nice on the shirts.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the oldest flags, by the way. I mean, it's the flag of the rising sun, a country which, of course, fought a war with the United States, but which is now a great friend and ally of the United States and has pursued, dare I say, very peaceful and foreign policy since the end of the Second World War. There's been some changes now, which we will one day discuss, no doubt. But it's a great civilization and a great country, and one whose culture I greatly admire.
All right. We'll leave it there. Take care, everybody.